You asked the question, is this an imperialist government? And the implication is that it is the government that we need to be fighting against. But I'm going to ask you a question, and this might be for the panelists. Do you actually believe that the individuals who are in government are running the government? And if they are not running the government, who is? And if you determine who is, why are we not attacking the true enemy?
Well, you know, my question wasn't a trick question.
Neither was mine.
Let me answer. My question is not a trick question. Those people who are running the government are carrying out the policies of the imperialists, which makes them imperialists. You know, they're carrying out the policies of the imperialists. Imperialist policies are carried out by governments. Troops are deployed by governments. Jails are created by governments. Police are government institutions. Those who are running those government institutions are the people on Wall Street, the big business, like they pointed out in the thing with the Philippines, you know, the corporations who mass millions and millions of dollars are the ones who are behind these actions. It is not our government, it's their government. It's acting on their behalf. It's not acting on our behalf. And that's why I said what I said in concluding, that we cannot expect them to act any other kind of way. That's the way they're going to act, you know. What we have to do is organize against those policies. And we have to organize the people that those policies are affecting. I'm sorry I gave such a long answer.
No, it's my pleasure. I wanted a long answer.
Did any of the other panelists want to comment on that?
In the Philippines, we believe we are targeting those imperialist interests by trying to fight for the liberation of the Philippines. We believe that it is an international enemy, and therefore we need an international movement. But we also see that the liberation of our people will lead towards the weakening of that enemy, that will lead towards the victory of the international movement. So I feel like that is how we are contributing, and that's why we're also building our community support here and our solidarity with the Filipino in this country, our host country that has adopted us. That's why we're endorsing CPAC. We're supporting USBCR and all the national liberations as well.
Any other questions for Frank specifically? Because he's the one who asked the leader. Rasmia.
I think always we are saying we have to work together, we have to coordinate together, always, in all our speech we are saying that. But we know there's a big problem in front of us. How do you think we can go forward in spite of these difficulties?
Well, you know, I don't have a clear and straightforward answer. I could sum it up in one word, struggle. But now, I think that, for example, October the 14th, okay, October the 14th, our organization is going to try to mobilize as many people as we can. Unless you tell us otherwise. To be there, to be present. And it's by that action, that we overcome some of the obstacles. And the more we do this, the more we take these kinds of actions, the more we learn how to do it. You know, we get smarter at it the more we do it. But I think the first thing we do right is struggle. That's the first thing, you know. And sure, there are obstacles, you know. And there are even some obstacles that we don't even see yet, you know, that are going to be thrown at. So we have to couch in and be prepared to struggle and be united in that struggle and not let artificial things divide us.
I'm going to open it up for people to ask questions to the rest of the panelists as well.
One more for Frank.
Oh, yes.
Just, I think you should tell folks what, like, is directly next in the civilian police accountability council struggle so that folks know. We just came out of a really impressive rally on August 29th, and what are you asking? What are the marching orders now?
You're right. Don't we have some flyers back there?
We do.
I was assuming that we had some back there. We should give those out to people so that it's not just my word. You got to remember. You read the flyer. But on September the 19th, well, two things. On September the 17th, we're going to be down at the police board. We know they're not going to do crap, you know. But we're going to be down there demanding that they fire Dante Servin, who's the murderer of Rekia Boyd. But most importantly, on the 19th, on Saturday the 19th, we're going to be at Trinity Church. I think it's 2 p.m. Is that what's on the literature? We're going to be at Trinity Church. And we're inviting all of you to be there with us to discuss with all of our allies and our partners in this struggle, what we see as the next step. You know, we got a blind side, so we're looking for you to help us out on our blind side. You know, but we're going to tell you what we see as the next steps in the struggle, and then together we hope we can hammer out an effective strategy for actually getting CPAC passed into law. Okay. Can I go now?
We still have you for 7 minutes.
Oh, 7 minutes.
because it's only 7 minutes, any last questions for Frank? Any final questions for Frank? Yeah. Right, do you have a question for Frank?
Yeah, I just thought I didn't think it would apply exactly. What about the killings of all these black and brown kids today? Like, how does this relate to this? What can we do about that? All these kids are getting killed daily in the black and brown neighborhoods.
That's why we're trying to take power.
I know, but I mean, I'm thinking how we can do something about it. That's what I'm trying to think of.
Well, we can do something about it by getting CPAC passed. You know, I mean, we don't have an army. Now, we can't deploy an armed force to go and stop them at this point of the struggle. It may come to that one day, but it ain't there now. Now what we need to do is, you know, muster all the forces that we possibly can to get this legislation passed, Civilian Police Accountability Council, which is really a radical piece of legislation, because what it does, it empowers the people in the community to hold the police accountable. It takes it out of the hands of the mayor, and it takes it out of the hands of the city council, you know. That's a big move. You know, if we can do that, we've done something, you know.
Your driver's ready.
All right, thank you so much, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
I'm going to call on Benjamin, and then you.
Yeah.
Yo. I have to say, union organizing there is amazing. If it weren't for unions like Kilusang Mayuno or the Main First Movement, right, communities in the Philippines, a lot of them would have been massacred. For example, in 2013, when I went to Compostela Valley, where there was a huge plantation, this foreign person came and started a plantation there. It is in the law that no foreigners are supposed to be able to build plantations there, but she found a loophole, obviously corruption, bureaucratic capitalism, going under the table, paying off those officials, right? So she was able to open a plantation by renting out the lands of the farmers. What that means is for decades, the farmers are only allowed to plant bananas. People in the Philippines don't eat bananas. We eat rice like 3 times a day. We drink rice as a snack. You know, we love our rice, but we can't even plant rice there. So people are going hungry. People are only getting paid so much. When we were there for that medical mission, there were planes flying above us spraying chemicals. And we left there coughing. And we were only there for half, for like a day, right? Imagine how what the repercussions were for the people. So, kinusang may uno, KMU is organizing there to protect the communities. The people went on strike, and they were able to halt the production, and they were able to win some games, but the fight continues. If it wasn't for the unions who are also deeply entrenched into the communities and supporting the community struggles, a lot of people would have been more worse off. And in Hashan de Luisita, one of our members, Maya, from Manapoyan, is also wearing a shirt. There was a massacre when there was a strike, and it wasn't for the unions continuing the organizing. I'm not saying that the people would fold, but that would make the conditions of the people worse. They were getting paid $9 a day. That's 10 cents a day for planting soybean. And this also includes the struggles of indigenous people in that as these lands are being taken, and the farm workers are being displaced. They don't have their land to till anymore. The farm workers are also being organized by the union. So in the Philippines, and this is why I got a little confused when I moved here, in the Philippines, all our struggles are united because it's one enemy. So it's actually my question why here in the U.S. it's separate. So I guess it's also a challenge in organizing here, but.
I've got the gentleman in the black hat.
Oh,
me? Yeah. I think it's black.
What is the name of the people, the native indigenous people? Is there one name, or is different indigenous people?
There are 14 indigenous tribes in Mindanao. Just kidding.
Also, you need some help. I'm sorry. I'm offering my help as an archivist.
For
the cause, myself, the individual.
Oh, thank you so much.
My girlfriend, when we're married, is from the Philippines.
Oh, hey.
But that's not the reason I will be for
it. Oh. It's okay, too. No, there's hundreds of indigenous groups in the Philippines, in Mindanao. They are collectively called Lumad. Lumad actually translates to from the earth. And the people from the earth.
Okay.
And when they are removed from the earth, from their ancestral lands, they look really bad. Yeah? So that's why there's a collective name for them. But there's Manobo, there's Maranao, and there's different beautiful tribes in the
Philippines.
Thank you. Joe, next.
I know each of the panelists touched on this, but I'd like to go back to the question of militarism at home and abroad, because this really was posed to the whole country, to the whole world, during the Ferguson uprising, when the people of Palestine reached out concretely, in a very specific terms initially, right, to give advice on how to counter the effects of tear gas for the people, fighting against the police in Ferguson, Missouri. So I guess I'm wondering if any of the panelists, I'm mostly thinking of Sundust, but if any of the other panelists would want to comment on, like, concretely, you know, what are the links that have emerged over the last year between the Palestinian struggle and the black struggle in the U.S., but also, you know, between other peoples facing occupation?
Really, I'll just echo what I stated before. It's just the idea that the police officials here and the ones that were actually in Ferguson were brought back to Israel and taught the tactics that they use and practice on the Palestinian people regularly. And so by perfecting that there, the United States figured that that would be the best way to teach them and to bring it back here and practice that in Ferguson and other places as well. So I don't really know otherwise.
In the Philippines, like you said before, our contribution to the international struggle is our struggle to the greater people. Any concrete connections or products of that continuation of linking here, I guess was the NATO march when we mobilized. I'm mobilizing in support for Resmia. Here locally.
We come out to support the movements, the actions in Chicago. But I can't think of anything in addition to that. I would like to ask, though, other members, because I'm just here to represent the struggle. I'm not the only one. Instead, I just do it. So if anyone of you want to share, to help me answer. Connecting.
I'm Nerissa from the National Alliance of Filipino Concerned, which I'm a pioneer member. One concrete example, because you want something concrete and really visual, is the San Francisco Police Department having a regular training on how to do urban control of civil disobedience and all these rallies and all that. So they have their training in Manila, which is the capital of the Philippines. So that's how the exchange goes. Or one example was in May 6th. President Aquino is supposed to go directly to Managua to have some kind of diplomatic activity. But in the last minute, which is like within 24 hours, we learned that he is dropping by Chicago. And why? Because our consul general used to be the consul general in Israel. And then he gathered together the Chicago Chamber of Commerce with Mayor Rabbi Manuel, and they have some deals with some more investment, which is beyond the bigger picture of neoliberal policies, which is more like localized between Chicago and Manila and Philippines, something like that. So that's how the direct link of powers are. And then the question next would be for us. How do we link our struggles? So that's why, even if we are starting here in Chicago to develop our militant movement, which is not as big or as militant as the West Coast and the East Coast, but we are strongly linking it because if we link to the struggle of the African-American and the Black community and Palestinian, then it makes us stronger. So that's how we see things. In the same way that 50 years ago, in September 8, the Delano farm workers, who are started by the Filipino farm workers, also, in a way, contribute to the whole civil rights movement and the farm workers' strike in the whole of the U.S.
Did any of the other panelists want to chime in? Briefly, I wanted to comment on something that's happened since Ferguson, is that since there was so much outrage over the militarization of the police, it really made it apparent that the police were acting like an occupying army. A lot of outrage over the way they've been, getting secondhand gear from the military, the leftovers. Obama has had to address that and is basically trying to initiate a sort of review or put a cap on police departments getting these crazy military equipment because of all the protest movements, that were basically calling attention to this. So it's kind of okay, that's a step in the right direction, but obviously, it's still in the hands of imperialists. And still, it's not gonna deliver justice. Okay, so the police won't have tanks anymore, but
I had a question for Lorena. I believe it was last year, there was a transgender woman, Jennifer Love, who was choked to death by a U.S. Marine in the Philippines. And because the murder fell under the Visiting Forces Agreement, the Philippine government has little to no say into prosecuting that U.S. Marine for his hate crime. So I guess I was wondering if there was either within the Philippines or within the U.S. sort of a coordination with the LGBT movement in sort of making that, bringing to light that mm-hmm. case, but also working together, to what you said, oppose a common enemy.
Just a little background on it. On November of 2014, Jennifer Lau, the trans woman, was killed by a U.S. Marine who was posted in the Philippines. And first of all, before I move on, there is a question about why is that U.S. Marine there? And there's a question of respecting the genuine sovereignty of a nation when another nation's military is there, right?
So why aren't they there in the first place? And so just a little background on that. About the Jennifer Fernandez campaign, there has been a strong push for it. I think it was actually Gabriela, which is the women's network, who's doing work for national democracy, but also focusing primarily on women's issues, and LGBT issues, is leading that campaign. And I know they came to Chicago actually for Encapia, and they did a workshop for it, and doing mobilizations and working with LGBT community, with the LGBT community for that. But I believe one of our members, Maya, would like to add something.
I also just wanted to comment that when I was there in January, a lot of the LGBTQ leaders were bringing this case up, right? Because the fact that so many transgender folks are killed in the Philippines with really no cases against them, right? Even here, it's the same case. They see the struggle and see also how it's connected to issues of like feudalism, how it's also connected to issues of capitalism. And we're building contingents of those folks as well, right, that are really starting to connect LGBTQ issues beyond that. In addition, a lot of the leaders within our groups are queer or LGBTQ, and it just kind of ends up happening that way because they, I think, live that experience and see how that oppression connects.
Yeah, this is a question for the mayor. Just a question of interest. I've read about Marxist groups in the Philippines, and I'm wondering if you can give any kind of information on it, because I read one source that say that they're defending against the imperialist governments, that they control some land. I hear one source saying that they're strong. I hear another saying that they're weak. Do you have any information on that, if anything's accurate?
So that goes back to the notion that there's a civil war in the Philippines, and that the people, putting aside all those fears, right, the genuine situation is that there's a civil war in the Philippines, people are dying. And there needs to be a fight so that these people no longer have to suffer, no longer have to lose their lands, and continue to live as human beings. And so I, from what I do know, there is Marxist organizing, communist organizing is there as well, but Anak Bayan is not a communist organization. I think Nerissa raised her hand. Would you like to add more on that? Oh, sorry.
Well, okay. Being part of a church, I'm a lay missionary and a church worker, so we're very active in peace campaign, peace talks during Aquino, Cory Aquino, the president after Marcos. I was working with the Catholic Bishops Conference in the Philippines, and I'm part of the independent monitoring body. So we're very updated about the peace question, but the question is, why do we need peace based on justice? And so it goes through so many years of being a colony and then a new colony. So we have the civil war, which is like a long civil war, but with the leadership now of the Communist Party of the Philippines, which was an establishment of the old, from the old party, which is established in 1968, this is now the one leading the struggle in the Philippines. Of course, there's parliamentary form of struggle, there's so many expression of the struggle, but the strong force determined to draw away imperialism in the Philippines and helping international proletarian struggle all over the world is the National Democratic Revolution in the Philippines, led by the Communist Party of the Philippines through its army, the National People's, the New People's Army, and the National United Front of the Philippines based in the Netherlands. Now they're trying to have the peace talks. There are already two things achieved with the peace talks since Aquino. President, the mother president, you know, after Marcos, which is about human rights. And we are really from different forces and tendencies that human rights is not only about the things that we know about human rights. Human rights should be self-determination of peoples. The self-determination of the Filipino people to have access and control of our own land, not the multinational company or the 1% big bourgeois comprador and big landlords in the country controlling all these resources. So that's why we respect the armed struggle in the Philippines, the church, I mean, I'm a lay missionary, but that's not a position by the church. Even the previous Pope said it's a just war. So that's the, and there is so many pretending to be so-called revolutionaries, but so far, after the 1992 rectification movement of the Communist Party of the Philippines, it's getting strong. It has 30,000 full combat army, leading more younger people to lead as commanders. We have so many Roman Catholic priests who are NPA commanders, you know that from history, so many sisters even. The church is really very involved because there's, you have no choice because of what's going on. So far, that's it. And we're expecting another Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Or maybe worse than Vietnam, because now you have drones, you have biological warfare, you have chemical warfare. Yeah. More than 100 million Filipinos, we don't know how much will be killed when this offensive will start, you know?
So, understanding that, like, there's different levels of occupation, would y'all agree that here in America, we don't have to, like, not, it doesn't necessarily have to be like what was happening in Ferguson, but the day-to-day existence of people of color in America, would you agree that we live under a form of occupation, or would you call it something else? As far as how we're, like, treated in our communities by the police on, like, a day-to-day basis.
Well, there was obviously occupation of the Native Americans.
I'm thinking more to, like, today. Like, me walking out of here, being in my neighborhood, would you agree that we live under a form of occupation?
Would you mind defining occupation, then?
Because I believe I live under occupation, all right? My white counterpart does not. It goes into level of degrees. Whether I'm in my hood or whether I'm in Wicker Park, there's a bit of a difference. I'm treated, but I still operate. The way they treat me is still with, like, impunity. And we see this everywhere. And they don't have to be having the tanks out there. It's, you know, they're wolf packs when they jump out in three. Like, I don't know, would you agree that that's occupation or that's just police brutality?
I would call that militarization.
Okay. I'm asking them more because, like, I've seen Mexico, and, like, and from my experience, but, like, you guys have also seen a way higher level of it. And would you call it the same thing?
I would call occupation when you are being removed from your ancestral land. The difference that's from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. I believe that the United States is a nation of immigrants, except for the Native Americans. So I would say that occupation specifically, and I guess this is my personal opinion on it, is happening with the Native Americans, even till now, right? Because California, that's not land of the United States, that's land of Mexico, stuff like that. But I believe that the people of color here, whether you're a current migrant or if you were born here, that we are getting militarized. So it is a form of militarization. I don't really know if it's a form of occupation.
You can call it oppression.
Yes, definitely oppression.
Or
occupation.
New occupation. Mm-hmm. Just like a neo-colonialization, it's a new occupation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I never thought of it that way. But, yeah.
I have Joe.
Well, I want to actually respond to this, because I think this is a really important question.
Yeah.
In the history of the struggle, especially of African Americans, the language of occupation emerged in the course of the 1960s. And part of this is because, you know, your point about land is important, Lorena. The historic land territory of African Americans is not in the North. It's in the South. You know, African Americans have only been in the North for the past century. They were in the South for the four centuries before that. And they were largely dispersed from the South, you know, in part because of their, you know, fleeing from Jim Crow and, you know, the apartheid they lived under, but also because of the mechanization of agriculture. Basically, the jobs disappeared from them. Shortly after arriving in the North, which they thought was going to be a form of, a more liberal society, a free society, they discovered that that, in fact, was not true. And so it was the Panthers, the Black Panther Party, that first put forward the idea that, in a popular way, I mean, there were others before that, but to make it truly popular, that the police in the African-American community are the same as an occupying army. That the African-American community is not, in fact, in control of the police. And that's why it was the Panthers that first put forward the idea that the goal, you know, because police brutality was a constant issue in the 1960s. Every time there was an urban rebellion in Harlem in 63, in Watts in 65, in Detroit in 67, there were incidents of police brutality and police murders that touched off those rebellions. And so the Panthers, in fact, everyone knows, like the famous story of that they arose immediately in response. They called themselves the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. What were they defending against? It wasn't Knight Riders or the Ku Klux Klan. It wasn't defending against, you know, vicious landlords or cruel capitalists. They were defending their community against murdering and brutal cops. And eventually, they in the early 70s, the Panthers put forward originally the idea of community control of the police. In fact, last year when we began, when I got involved in the campaign for the Civilian Police Accountability Council, I had four old activists, African American and white, in Chicago, older than me, who said they were circulating petitions for a Civilian Police Accountability Council in 1971, under the direction of the Chicago Black Panther Party. And it was not just in Chicago, it was a nationwide campaign, locally based, but it was a campaign that was going on in cities around the country. So, and then, you know, I think subsequent to the Panthers putting it forward, the Chicano revolutionaries also, in East LA, put forward the idea of an occupied community. The Chicanos, who are also an oppressed nation within the United States, in my opinion, that their community in East LA was also not theirs, that the police there served as an occupying army. So it's a different form of occupation, just like, you know, national oppression takes different forms. In some countries, national oppression takes the form of a direct, you know, colonial power sitting on top of you, like Palestine. In other countries, national oppression takes the form of an occupying army, like when Bush invaded Iraq. In other countries, a national oppression takes the form of a proxy army, like in Syria. But, you know, these are all forms of national oppression, and similar, there are different forms of occupation.